Welcome back to Tanya 200. We're going through the chapters of the first part of Tanya on the occasion of its 200th birthday, the 200th anniversary since the first publication of the Tanya. We're about to begin chapter 18, but before we do, let's review what we've covered until now. We have two souls, the godly soul and the human soul. The godly soul has intelligence, emotions, and garments. Garments being thought, speech, and deed, which are also called behavior. The natural soul also has intelligence, emotion, and garments. Only the intelligence and the emotion and the garments of the godly soul are all godly. The godly soul understands godliness. That's what makes sense to the godly soul. The godly soul has godly emotions. It loves and fears God and all the other emotions. And its garments are all godly. Godly thought, godly speech, godly action, which means the fulfillment of the commandments. When you do commandments, you're doing godliness. When you speak of the commandments or the study of Torah, then you are speaking godliness. And when you're thinking of it, you're thinking godliness. The natural soul, its intelligence is natural, which means creation makes sense, not creator. The concrete makes sense, not the abstract. Emotionally, the natural soul loves and fears what it sees, what it can touch. It doesn't love and fear what is invisible. And in its garments, the human soul, sometimes called the animal soul, thinks and speaks and does what its emotions and what its intelligence dictates. So you have a battle between two souls, not just two impulses, like the evil inclination and the good inclination, but two complete souls, which means two complete personalities, a complete, intelligent, feeling, behaving creature. Only it can be godly or it can be human. Of course, the human is indiscriminate in what it wants or what it does, because it pursues pleasure generically, regardless of whether the pleasure is permissible or forbidden, proper or improper, and so on. In order to be able to serve God, we need to win over the natural soul, the animal soul, and get its cooperation, get it to join us in the fulfillment of the commandment, which is not that difficult if we're just going to do and say and think what God wants us to think and do and say. But if we're going to serve God with our heart, in other words, if we're going to have some emotion, if we're going to invest the mitzvah with feeling, here the struggle is a little more difficult to get the natural soul to allow godly feeling without distraction, without resistance. We therefore have the tzaddik, whose godly soul doesn't resist at all. His godly soul has been transformed. It too wants godliness. That's why he's a tzaddik, that's why he's a saint. Then you have the person who cannot control his animal soul, even in the garments. He can't even get the animal soul to behave the way he would like to behave. And therefore, This is a person who will sin or has sinned. But then you have the person in the middle, which is the ideal for which we strive, and that is that although we can change the emotions of the animal soul, we can't get the animal soul to give up its loves and its fears and its pleasures, yet we can get the animal soul to allow us to do and to speak and to think always, exclusively, that which God desires and that which God prefers. in order to have the emotions that go with the observance, the Tanya says that we need to come to know God so vividly, to understand godliness, the greatness of God, so vividly that that knowledge can produce an emotion in the heart, to give birth, literally, to an emotion in the heart that will overwhelm in its intensity the impulses of the natural soul, and we will neutralize temporarily the feelings of the animal soul, and we will do the commandment, fulfill the mitzvah, with love and fear of God, without distraction for the moment. But that's an ambitious thing. Somewhat less ambitious, which encompasses more people, is that we need only to arouse a conviction of the heart. Our knowledge of God needs to be sufficient to produce a conviction, even if it can't produce an actual emotion. A conviction of the heart, wisdom of the heart, where the person recognizes in his heart, not just abstractly or academically in the mind, but in the heart, he recognizes that the only right thing, what is proper, what is correct, and what ought to be, is that every creature should be devotedly serving his Creator and wanting to be closer, to expire and to become absorbed in the Creator, because the Creator is true and real, and creation is temporary and shallow. And so that motivates the person, animates the observance of the commandment, so that the commandment is light, it has wings with which to rise. Chapter 18 is probably one of the most dramatic, revolutionary statements in Tanya. Because in chapter 18, the Rebbe says that we've explained how it is close to the average person to be able to serve God with the heart. But in the verse that we're quoting, it is very close to you in your mouth and in your heart to do. Moshe is saying to the people that it is very close. Korev elecha hadavar ma'id. Very close. So we've explained why it's close, but we haven't yet explained how it's very close. And to explain that, the Rebbe says, we need to know with absolute certainty and without a shadow of a doubt that even a person whose knowledge of God is very limited, not only can't he give birth to an actual intense emotion in the revealed part of his heart that loves and fears God, but he isn't even capable of producing a conviction in the heart. His heart is too coarse to respond to anything abstract or refined. And this is not a fault of his own. It's not that he needs to work harder. This is the way he was created. He is a very physical human being, and abstract thoughts just don't reach him. So he can't even arouse a conviction in the heart by virtue of his knowledge of God. Such a person can serve God with his heart, not only with actions, and not some external insignificant part of the heart, but as the Rebbe puts it, from the depth of his heart, in absolute truth, with love and fear. In the earlier chapters, when the Rebbe spoke about the intense love that can be produced in the heart by a thorough knowledge of God, he never called it an absolutely true love. He called it an intense love, a real love, a fiery love, a tangible love. He never described it as emes la'amite, absolutely true. where is this love and fear coming from if the person doesn't have the wisdom even to produce a conviction in the heart? The answer is, it's coming from the love that exists in the godly soul, which we are born with, which we inherit from our patriarchs. So it's there even if we know nothing. And this love, when it's active, is not the product of our understanding of God's greatness. It is the product of a godly soul. So it is more real, more true, than the greatest love that the mind can produce, the greatest love that intellect can produce, cannot compete, cannot compare to the absolute validity and truth of the love that a soul has by its very nature, which is inherited from the patriarchs. But to understand this, we have to understand three things. Number one, what kind of a love is this? Number two, how do we inherit love? And number three, if we inherit love, where does the fear come from? How is fear included in the love? So in chapter 18, the Rebbe begins to explain, what does it mean to inherit love? We are told that the patriarchs were not only good people, they were not only holy, but they were the embodiment of divine attributes. In other words, Abraham, for example, was the embodiment of divine kindness. Yitzchak was the embodiment, the personification of divine justice or fear. And Jacob, Yaakov, was the embodiment of divine compassion or truth. What does it mean to be the embodiment? You can have a human being who is basically human, but is so good, so devoted to God, that they become holy in their devotion, and they are saintly in their commitment, and so they acquire a certain godliness or a certain holiness by virtue of their choice. Because they chose to be good, because they chose to be holy, because they chose to pursue godliness, they attain a certain amount of godliness and holiness. Now, such a person will obviously have children who are also very refined and very sensitive and so on, but where that sensitivity and refinement is going to go cannot be predicted. So, for example, if there's a person who is a very loving person, his whole life is a life of love and kindness, naturally their children will also love and be kind. But who are they going to love? This can't be predicted. There's no reason that they would love the same people or the same things that the parents love. Because you can inherit a disposition, but you can't inherit a relationship. So you can be predisposed to being a loving person, but you don't automatically inherit the love that your parents have for a certain individual. The patriarchs didn't love God by choice. They loved God because they were godly. And therefore, every child born to them is automatically, inevitably, irrevocably godly. They inherit a godliness, not just an attitude towards godliness. That's why a Jew is born Jewish. So we inherit this godliness. What is this godliness? There are 10 divine attributes. And every soul comes through these attributes, or from these attributes. The highest of the 10 attributes is called Chachma. It is the first of the mental faculties in the soul, which devolves from the divine attribute of Chachma. Now, although this is a mental faculty, it is not yet a knowing faculty. Knowing begins in Bina, which is the second attribute. Chachma means an openness to what is. It doesn't know anything, but it is open, it is receptive of what is unknown. And through the Chachma, whatever is knowable, whatever knowledge there is, whatever reality there is, becomes available to the Bina, which actually understands it. So, the faculty of Bina needs to master a subject, to sink its teeth, mental teeth, into a subject. Chachma doesn't care to master the subject. Chachma is curious about what it doesn't know. That's why the godliness of the godly soul is available. God is available to the soul in the stage, in the level of Chachma. Because God is not knowable, because intelligence cannot encompass God, God is not available to Bina, because Bina needs to know. That which Bina can't understand frustrates Bina and makes it unhappy. Chachma doesn't need to understand. It's just curious about what is. And therefore, God can make himself known to Chachma, even though God is beyond comprehension. Because Chachma doesn't care to comprehend. Chachma just wants to see what is. And so Chachma can apprehend God. Chachma can be conscious of God as God is. And maybe that's what the meaning of seeing is believing. There's a part of our soul that doesn't care to know, it just wants to see. And that's where God appears to the soul. God makes himself known to the soul in Chachma. Now, since every soul comes from the divine attributes, even a person born to the most vulgar, to the most corrupt parents, the soul is of the lowest of the divine attributes. But since all divine attributes are connected, it's all part of the holy, the godly, therefore, even the soul that comes from the lowest of the ten attributes contains and is connected to that attribute of Chachma, in which God is present, visible, almost natural. And that's what we mean by faith. When we say that we believe in something, it means that we don't know it. Because if you know it, you don't have to believe it. Belief means that we are conscious, we are aware, we are in touch with something that we can't understand. Which faculty do we have that can touch that which we can't know? The Chachma. That attribute of Chachma, which is precognitive, it doesn't care to understand and know, it just is open to what is, that's where our faith takes place. That which is visible to the part of the soul that is Chachma, that's what we believe in. What is visible to that part of the soul? Truth. That which is because it is, not because we understand it. And so God, who is the way he is, because he is, that's what the Chachma of our soul perceives. And that's called faith. Emunah. Which explains why in Jewish history, or how in Jewish history, the martyrdom of the average Jew, not of the great sages of the Talmud, but the martyrdom of the average Jew who refused to give up his religion, who refused to give up his faith in God, who refused to give up his identity as a Jew, when in fact all his life he had ignored godliness, had ignored his Jewishness, and certainly hadn't made it his life. So if a person devotes his life to something, whatever it may be, to democracy, to freedom, to money, to a job, and then that devotion is threatened, the person who devotes his life to freedom is told that his freedom will be taken away, it almost makes sense that he would die protecting his freedom. He had made that his life. Without that, his life loses all meaning. So he's willing to give up his life rather than live without his freedom. But why would anyone give up their life for something that they didn't devote their lives to? So if it hasn't been the focus of your life, why can't you live without it? Why won't you live without it? And yet we find in Jewish history that Jewish martyrdom was primarily on the part of Jews who were peripheral to the Jewish community, whose commitment to Judaism was very doubtful and tenuous, who were logically, supposedly, easy victims, could easily be drawn away from their religion, and yet those are the ones who refused at the pain of death. Where does that come from? How does someone who doesn't know God, who doesn't understand God, and even if they understood, they never bothered to sit and contemplate it, it was not the focus of their lives, and yet not only do they believe in God, but that belief is so strong that they can't give it up even if it costs them their lives. That's the chokhmah of the soul. The chokhmah, which is broken into two words, kayachma, the potential for what is. That part of the soul doesn't need to understand. It doesn't need to grasp. It doesn't need to master the subject. It is conscious of what's out there. It's conscious of what is true, even if it doesn't comprehend it. So that's where faith takes place, and that's why it's possible to be devoted to such an intense degree, to be so clear-minded about what we believe and who we are, even if we can't explain it, even if we can't put it into words, even if we can't comprehend it ourselves. So it's very likely that these martyrs, while they were being martyred, as they were giving up their lives, were marveling at themselves. They must have been asked, what am I doing? They had no explanation for it. So when they were asked, why won't you worship the idol? It was a good question. They didn't know the answer. They couldn't think of an answer. And that's because this was coming not from the bina of their soul, but from the chachma of their soul. The love that we have for God also comes as a result of this chachma rather than any kind of knowledge that produces love. So when a person, in a scholarly fashion, understands God, as King David says, know the God of your fathers and serve him with your whole heart. To the degree that you know God, to that degree you serve him with a whole heart. So the more you know, the greater is the emotion. But these are emotions, love and fear, that are created and generated by the knowledge. No matter how much we know of God, it's only a tiny bit. It's still restricted and limited to the finite capacity of a human mind. And there's much more to God than any mind will ever comprehend. So even if we do understand God, and we understand something about God so vividly, he is so real, he's so tangible, that the heart can actually respond with an excitement and with an emotion. That is true, that's real, that's valid, but it is not called absolutely true. Which emotion can be absolutely true? The love that a person experiences, not as a result of his understanding of God, but by the presence of God himself. When God's presence makes you love him, that's absolutely true. There's no interference here of human reasoning, of personal perceptions. This is the soul reacting to God directly because of God's presence. I guess that's what's called seeing. The difference between seeing and hearing. In hearing, when you hear about a building, for example, you create in your mind a mental image so that you can see it in your mind's eye. But you're creating the image, and it could be off. Whereas seeing with your eye means that the building itself presents itself to your mind and it makes an impression on your mind. It can't be wrong. You can't have a wrong picture when it itself is the picture. So when God presents himself to the chachma of the soul and that causes a person to love God, that love is absolutely true. And that's the love that we can't produce, but we can inherit.